Well, here we are. It's August again, and here I am in a corner of the Sunshine Coast Festival of the Written Arts office. My name is Sean Eckford. I'm one of the festival board members, and I also produce our daily podcasts. Today, Friday, August 18th, was day one, but what I'm going to do is take us back a day for our opening reception and our opening event. We don't often hear from Festival Board President John Lussier on the podcast, but during last night's opening, he had some interesting thoughts on the festival's future.
We are so excited that this weekend is here. You'll notice the new lighting in the pavilion. We have real-time captioning again this year. And next year, oh man, we put in a grant for some laser lights, pyrotechnics, a dry ice fog machine. Simon, it's going to be epic.
Nice. We're bringing a drummer next year.
We are pretty sure he was joking. That enthusiastic endorsement you heard, by the way, was Simon Parody, a friend of the festival who's been on the stage before, including with his wife, Kira Stanley, talking about her book, Fallen. But last night, he was the self-described stunt guitarist for Adriana Barton, the author of Wired for Music. With Simon's musical help, Adriana talked about how music affects the brains and behavior of people, including this note of hope for those of us who've maybe always thought we were tone deaf or just didn't get music.
And this idea that many people have that they're tone deaf or couldn't carry a beat is largely to do with the exposure or non-exposure you had to music growing up. Because when they do brain work with people, they find that only around 2% of people are truly unable to distinguish the fine pitch discrimination and the beat. It's very rare, true
right.
Cognitive difficulties with music.
People's reticence to want to actually openly be musical is nature, not nature.
It's largely cultural, and it's quite sad. And again, in my book, there's a part that explains what happened in Western Europe to create those circumstances, and the event was 2,000 years ago, roughly, and I'm not going to say more about it here.
Simon and Adriana closed off their performance with having the crowd sing along to the Robbie Robertson tune, The Wait, which led to a bit of discussion afterwards about what the correct lyrics to the chorus actually are. I talked to some people who thought it's Take a Load Off Fanny. Others thought it was Annie. One or two even thought it was Granny. Now, it turns out that the lyrics as written by Robertson are Fanny. I don't know if you can tell in this clip whether or not members of the audience are all singing different versions.
All right. Take a load off Fanny. Yeah. Take a load from Free. Take a load off Fanny. Andy, put the load right on me.
We started the day hearing from Tamar Globerman and Hilary Peach, who've both written books about their experiences as women working in what you might consider non-traditional fields. Globerman was a whitewater rafting guide. Peach was a welder and fabricator. And at one point, they were asked by the moderator, Kate Braid, what advice they would have for people going into non-traditional jobs like they did. And I think it's, although the question was framed as advice for women, it could apply to anybody.
It's a really hard one, but I think, you know, if you love it, go for it. Like, it's one of the things, like, don't let other people's ideas dictate what you do. Like, you know, like, it's easy for, even when I started raft guiding and I was guiding on easier stuff, like, a lot of people are just sort of, like, expecting that that's where I would stay, you know, and that's what people project on you, and it does help, definitely, to have role models and to have people in your court, which I had both of, but there's also and probably if you look around, most people, I think you can both attest to that, you'll find those people that are in your court and will help you get along. As long as you show up and you're fully into it, and And yeah, I mean, you have to be focused, and you have to be ready to sort of ignore or something, like all the people that are going to tell you that you can't do it, because there's going to be those people. There's going to be people that project all this, you know, negativity on you and see you as a weak person and all this, just because they look at you, they don't even know anything about you. They look at your size, they look at your gender, and just, you know, you've got to look beyond those people to the people that are going to support you.
Excellent. I don't know if you remember this, but about 25 years ago, you gave me a really good piece of advice.
No.
You said, that I believe someone had given to you, but you said, before you start a cut, you always watch and see where your non-trigger hand is. Like, right? Like, before you light up the skill cell, where's my other hand? Like, oh, I'll just put that over here. Like, and I kind of... I always remember that, and I always kind of keep it sort of morphed into a metaphor for me. Like, always know what your other hand is doing. Always have something else going on. Have a backup plan in a way. So my advice, I guess, would be to have a backup plan. I had a rough time because I was entering into a culture that was particularly hostile at the time that I entered into it, and I took a year off to think things over. And I went back, and the thing that changed it for me is that I gave myself permission to leave at any moment. I trained in some other things, and I had a backup plan. So I just decided that if anything became intolerable, whether it was a dangerous situation or a situation with another person or whatever, I could just walk away. And I never did. But as soon as I had that permission, it kind of, I settled right down and everything sort of became a lot easier, right? Like, I can just, you know, I'll go and start a flower shop. That was always my thing. You know, I'm just like, you guys are stupid. I'm leaving. I'm going to go start a flower shop. And I'd love to have a flower shop.
Well, there's right? still time.
There's still time. This is true.
By the way, Kate Braid's book that Hilary Peach mentioned there is Hammer and Nails, Notes of a Journeywoman, about her years as a carpenter. Now, it's not unusual for our festival authors to have family members and friends in the audience with them, and Carrie Mack, who was discussing her first adult novel last winter, noted that her mom was in the audience and also mentioned some of the hazards associated with that.
So there's my mom, which basically ruins the whole presentation, so... I tried to sanitize it a bit, and it is not a memoir. It's not marketed as that. I didn't write it as that. In fact, it is the result of not writing a memoir that became this book of fiction. However, I'm deeply disturbed that my mom's here. Really, it's really terrible. She reads my books. She reads all the books. In fact, she reads all the books of every author presenting every single year. Not all the books, but she is a very prolific reader. So I know she reads lots of hard stories and books about difficult things, but she never says much when she reads mine. So she read this, and I have a kind of a private contract with myself that I don't ask her what she thinks of my books. And all she offered was, I really like the description of the small town experience.
The Friday schedule had a few highly anticipated events, John Valiant, Angela Sterrett, and Bob McDonald. Now, Angela and Bob were late in the day, so we'll have to catch up with their presentations on tomorrow's edition of the podcast. John was talking about his book, Fireweather, Making of a Beast. Now, this, of course, is, with everything going on right now, a topic that is really close at hand for quite a few people. And during the Q&A, John was asked a couple of things. One was, you know, how to get our government leaders, our local leaders, our federal and provincial leaders, actually taking some action on the issues raised by the increasing dangers of wildfire. And he was also asked by a journalist in the audience what reporters could be doing more.
So these are conversations that we really need to have in our community with people like you, but with our fire chiefs, with our mayors and city councils. And I know people who've read this book or who've been through it who are trying to have those conversations, and they're getting some pushback. Again, a lot of people want to have their status quo. Harrison Hot Springs is really beautiful just the way it is. Well, actually, it's a wicked fire trap. There's only one road out, and it's lined with steep-sided forest. If you close that entrance, everyone in there gets cooked. It's super dangerous, and I know a guy who's trying to raise this consciousness. And one way to do it, Stephen, and the way that this fellow in Harrison Hot Springs is doing it, he got in touch with Chief Jamie Coots, who's the fire chief, who you'll get to know if you read this book, an amazing guy from Slave Lake, who was as blindsided as everybody else when that fire came through his community in 2011. He's become an evangelist for kind of fire consciousness, fire safety, escape routes, how to look at your community in an intelligent, fire-centered way. What this invites us to do is to empathize with this thing that is actually closer to us than we realize. You know, we have our own ideas for how Seychelles should be, for how Vancouver should be. We have our own vision of it that we've imposed on it. Fire also has its own plans when it gets loose. So we need to learn to think like a fire. That's what good incident commanders do. That's what good fire bosses do. That's why they talk about character and mood. And it's really important. And we need to learn that language too. We need to speak that language in our communities and look at our communities, which are flammable. The modern house really burns. There's a lot of petroleum in there. So I think a lot of people are resonating to that question, Stephen. I certainly am. And I know people are trying to have those conversations now. And it's a new idea. Some people find it scary, intimidating, challenging, certainly challenging to the status quo. But we have to face it bravely. And, you know, I tried to do it with this book. It gave me gray hair to do it. You know, that's a price I guess I paid. But my vanity will have to suffer for that. But I really hope this book can be helpful, and I'm glad people are asking those questions.
What can journalists and citizen journalists and people on Twitter and people who have a voice and have a platform, what are the messages you'd like to see us sharing? Because you have a wide breadth of knowledge that I don't have, because I have to also cover school board and, you know, talk to Johnny, who's, you know, won an award.
Sure.
So I can't always be the disaster journalist.
Oh, that's important too.
As, you know, we don't have all of the time to put our resources towards disaster journalism. But, you know, I was in very heavily involved in the flooding coverage in Abbotsford and Hope as well. So if we only have 2 minutes to get a message out to people in their limited capacity for reading a story, what would you want us to tell them?
Wow. Let's see. Well, you're the journalist, you know. Anyway, I'm so glad you're here and talk to this lady. We should follow each other on Twitter, by the way. This is kind of what I do all the time on Twitter, is sort of try to get these little tidbits out. But one of the things that I lean on the most is that 21st century fire is different, that it moves faster than you think it's going to, that everybody in these communities that are being impacted by these fires that are now front page news on a weekly basis, as I said earlier, all of them have been shocked by the speed. And so when the flames are out there, don't think that's where all of the fire is. And that the wind is the driver. The wind is almost like its own kind of fuel. I mean, it carries oxygen, right? But it also carries the embers. And that the speed of the wind, and one way to think about it is, the fire may be out there looking static on the mountainside, but actually fire moves as fast as the wind. And if it's blowing 30 knots, it was blowing pretty good this morning, just off the coast of Seychelles, that's how fast the fire can move. Maybe not the main body of the fire, but absolutely the embers. And as dry as BC has been, you got to assume if that ember lands that a fire will be generated from it. And so it's almost we have to, it's very easy to get distracted by that, those massive flames on the mountainside that are across the river, across the lake, far away from you. But it's almost, it's a distraction. Focus on the wind and what the wind is bringing. And so if you're feeling it on you, that means embers could be coming with it right over the top of you. So that would be one. I think there's this, you know, really important emphasis by community leaders not to incite panic. But I think that really backfired in Fort McMurray. I think we saw that starting to go a little bit sideways in Yellowknife, and then it turned. You know, the mayor was saying these very kind of dampening things, you know, and including, you know, don't try to think about this too much. Don't try to plan it out. Well, you really should be trying to plan it out. And she didn't mean that in a cynical way. I think she was, don't let your imagination get away from you. But actually, we don't even need to let our imaginations get away from us because the data is there. What happened to Fort McMurray, what's happening to Kelowna right now, what happened to Enterprise, it can happen here. It can happen at, you know, in Lytton. And none of us is immune from that anymore. And so we really, I mean, it's a kind of, it invites a kind of solidarity. These are our fellow citizens who are going through this now by the tens of thousands. So they are us. They're seeing a possible future that could be ours too if we're not careful or not lucky. And one way to show solidarity for them, one way to honor the suffering and terror and just massive inconvenience that they're going through is to educate yourself and be proactive. You know, what would I do if I needed to get out of here in 30 minutes? Where are the kids exactly? Where is the stuff that I care about most? And what's hard, I think, is once you start thinking about that, you open the door to that possibility. And one guy said to me, this really lovely man, I think his name is John Knox. He was a DJ for a country station up in Fort Mac. He said, it was almost as if by talking about it, we were giving the fire oxygen. And it's really profound. And I really get that. You don't want to talk about bad things. You don't want to talk about evil things. You don't want to bring that energy into your mind or into your life. And, you know, most of us aren't superstitious, but there still is sort of that feeling, you know, if I sort of spend time around that energy, maybe it'll get on me. And so we got to talk about it. And there's a way to talk about it that can actually protect us. And I'm really glad you're doing your work because journalists are a key delivery system for not just for that information, but also for having those conversations.
Now, as I mentioned, the subject of fire weather is incredibly current right now. And in fact, so much that John wrote an op-ed that was published just this morning by the Globe and Mail. And that was one of the things I asked him about when I caught up with him after his presentation. Read your op-ed this morning in the Globe, and I have to ask, are you one of our many Globe-associated authors who's been working while you've been at the festival?
Yeah, I just filed an op-ed on preemptive evacuation just this morning. So that's what I was working on all yesterday and last night, and it just went live. So that's out there in the Globe and Mail, and then I'm going to be on The Current and on CTV first thing Monday morning, so talking about fire.
Did you expect when you wrote this that it was going to generate as much interest in work as it has compared to like just the regular round of book interviews?
I didn't think Canada would catch on fire in 2023. You know, I mean, I knew it was a risk. I knew that Fort McMurray, something like that, was bound to happen again, and we needed to get ready for it. I had no idea. No one saw Halifax coming, and then it just seems like every week there's another really big one. Kelowna has 150,000 people in it. You know, that's a major, that's a serious city, and especially for Canada. So we're in a moment now. 2023, things are going to be different after this summer. I'm
now,
quite sure of it.
We've had authors here. Ed Struzik comes to mind. You've touched on very similar themes, very similar ways, and John in extroing you today had mentioned that there's hope at the end of the book.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, you know, as you look around and just the critical mass we've got now, are you finally thinking that people with the message like yours are out of the Cassandra zone and are getting listened to?
They're getting listened to at different levels. Preemptive evacuation is much more policy now than it used to be. In terms of connecting the dots to climate, to connecting the dots to the petroleum industry, to our own consumption and habits, that's harder for people because that really intrudes on people's bottom line and it intrudes on their status quo. And again, you know, we talked about that people will pretzel themselves to an extraordinary degree to maintain their status quo.
Well, I think that's where we'll leave it for our wrap-up of day one, except for this. One of our greatest hits here on the Festival Podcast is journalism professor and frequent festival guest Catherine Gretzinger on how you should be asking a good question during our presentations, because we do still have lots of events to come and tickets available for those events. You can visit writersfestival.ca or drop by Rockwood in downtown Sechelt. Just remember, when it's your turn to ask a question, here's how Catherine thinks you ought to go about it.
They should ask a hardworking, open-ended question. They should pause and think, what do I want to know? And then they should ask their question. They should ask one question at a time. They should not ask a question that drives a guest into a box. They should ask a question that opens a window. The same kind of things that I tell my students.
I was going to say, that seems like awfully familiar advice.
Yeah, it's interesting. In some events, people stand up to tell their own story, and I don't think that's particularly helpful. It's supposed to be about the author that's on the stage. So just remember, the event is about the author that's on the stage. The luxury of having an open microphone and being able to ask a question is to ask one that other people will benefit from, not just you.